From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Chernia.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And this morning, we first speak with Nick Mucha, the Environmental Capacity Building Director at Patagonia and co-editor of the recently published book, Tools to Save Our Home Planet. The book features contributions from 56 environmental leaders and is set to serve as a reassuring and inspirational companion to environmental justice movements.
Then, Park City local and ecologist and friend of the show, Sarah Jo Dickens, comes on to discuss best practices for gardening and lawn maintenance as we head into the spring season, which starts somewhere around late June.
Yes, generally.
Okay. All that and some news about a planned European Union rule regarding deforestation, which could dramatically impact coffee production and sales from Africa, particularly Ethiopia. Environmental awareness and education, that's what this Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
And our first guest this morning is Nick Mucha, the Environmental Capacity Building Director at Patagonia and co-editor of the recently published book, Tools to Save Our Home Planet. Nick, thank you so much for being a part of the show today.
Oh, I'm so excited. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so just a little bit of background on yourself, please, as we get this started. Tell us how you began your journey with Patagonia.
My journey with Patagonia is about 7 years on now. I came to Patagonia from the grassroots nonprofit sector. I've been, over the past 20 years, kind of played a variety of roles. I have founded my own organization, was executive director, led, you know, the organizing and programmatic functions across a variety of organizations, and had the opportunity to join Patagonia to help them better support the grassroots movement out there. How do we show up meaningfully to advance that work and protect all the important places and communities that we care about?
And now you've compiled this book and you were an editor on it that brings together 56 contributors. How did you go about this? What was the process first for laying the foundation for this book and compiling all these voices?
Yeah, well, it started by looking at our previous edition of this book. We had a book that was published in 2016 called Tools for Grassroots Activists. And it was about 5 years ago, a little bit beyond that, where we had just kind of an exploratory meeting, trying to assess, like, what do we want to update? You know, times are changing. Should we kind of swap out some pieces? And that turned into a five-year journey where we completely overhauled the book. From top to bottom. And I would say if there's anything that I learned in the process, it is that this was so much a group effort. There are so many individuals that came together to lay the foundation and really connect with the best practitioners in the field to bring the right voices through this book. So it has been a journey and a very exciting one.
Nick, you wrote the introduction provocatively titled, "Dude, F This, I'm done."
Yeah.
Please elaborate.
Yeah, that's what my kids said. They're like, "Dad, what does that mean?" And so I really had to backpedal a little bit. But what it means is, like I said, I've been in this work for, you know, about 20 years. And anybody that is showing up day in and day out, you know, whether it's in a small, scrappy nonprofit organization or elsewhere, if you're engaged in trying to drive change, I can assure you that there are many days where you wake up and you figure, God, I'm not making any progress. It's like anybody even noticing the amount of effort I'm pouring into this, does it even matter? And so that's where the title came from. I mean, that I had many, many times said, dude, F this, I'm done. But luckily, I found a way to dig deep and find another day.
It can get a little bit overwhelming and exasperating to think about some of the issues that we need to tackle or talk about and bring to the forefront. So you kind of laid this book out in a way that really is almost a guidebook or a how to even start.
Yeah, I'm glad that came through. That was very intentional. We want this to be kind of tracking the activist journey, so to speak. And we really think that starts with introspection and questioning, you know, what are the things that you care most deeply about? Getting clear about that And then really starting to grapple with how do you show up? Like, where do you meaningfully contribute in this fight, in this battle of our lifetimes? And that's a question that only each and every one of us can answer ourselves. So the book goes from that point of introspection and reflection, and then kind of starts to build upon that. So how do you engage with organizations? How do you show up professionally? How do you work across organizations and build coalitions and build movements and communicate and fundraise and lobby? So it really does kind of start to stack on top of the previous chapter in a way that hopefully all of us are bold enough to track in our own real lives.
Right. And so there's some 11, 12 chapters, a nice arc to them. And the first one, the ongoing evolution of a change maker. I like the fact that each chapter has cites specific examples of the idea or the theme of that chapter, and talk a little bit about the change makers and with respect to, say, the Klamath River work and the Montana teenage activists and their climate change efforts.
Yeah, oh my gosh. For anybody that's interested in getting inspired and seeing real world examples of things working, it's just dripping with examples. You've already named two, but I think it's really important for us to remember that, yes, as titled in my piece, this is hard work, and yet it pays off. Like, there will be results, maybe different than what you set out to achieve, but through that hard work and actually taking this work dead seriously, you are able to, in fact, achieve results. And, I think one thing that is noted in that beginning chapter that I like to call out is, Annie Leonard, who ran Greenpeace for a number of years and effectively so, she goes on, and I'm paraphrasing here, but one thing that she noted is that when people start getting involved in something and pour themselves into it, you start to think it's like a sprint. Like, you're just going to give 110% every single day. But as you deepen in that work, you realize, wait a second, I've got to kind of save some room for myself. And so it becomes more of a marathon. So you have to pace yourself accordingly if you want to be doing this over the long haul. And then what she noted that I loved was that as you get older and as you've been in this work for decades, you realize that's not a sprint or a marathon. Rather, this is a relay race. And so how do we take this as far as we can and make sure that we're passing the baton to the next generation or to our next door neighbor or our colleagues at work? And it really is this inclusive and additive experience where we're bringing people into the work alongside us. So I was really struck by that. And I hope that, this today's show is, an example of us passing the baton to other folks.
Right.
I love that part of this, that it does feel like when you look to take something on and it feels large, it's hard to know where to begin. But if you have these steps, or you have that person that has walked in these footsteps prior to you, and you can see that path and then also see what you personally can do to help push that forward, is so valuable, because it makes us all feel like we have a part in this together. And I think about this next generation. This book is coming at a time where I think that this next generation, it really helps for them to see someone that pushed forward in a way that was successful, and that they can do that too.
Yeah. I think, that's a great point. The stakes could not be higher. We are operating in a world that is changing at a dizzying pace. So how do we contribute? How do we help to build the future that we want for ourselves and, future generations? And I think, again, pulling from Annie Leonard's wisdom, she noted that one question that she gets asked a lot, and I'm sure many of us here, is, I'm just one person. Like, honestly, let's be real. What can I do? I think we all kind of contend with that notion of, oh my God, climate change, like what me bringing my bags to the grocery store, is that really going to help? Mm-hmm. And her response, I think, is very clarifying, which is, don't be just one person. Get a friend, join a group, like, be bigger than just your one individual contribution. So this is a collective puzzle that we need to solve and continue to bring more and more people into.
Right. And in fact, there's a couple of chapters that kind of highlight those. One is called Working Together. And another one that's really interesting is Partnering with Others. Talk a little bit about partnering with others, how important it is to sometimes find partners that you didn't think were either out there or maybe had a kind of a separate cause or so, but there's a common element to some some partners.
Absolutely. We need to build the biggest tent we can. This should be an inclusive movement. I think, you know, the data speaks for itself that, for example, Americans across, you know, the partisan divide overwhelmingly support public lands. Like, people don't want public lands rolled back. People do not want oil and gas and mineral extraction on our public lands. So why should this be relegated to the environmental movement to be speaking about? This is something that we all hold dear and hold in common. So how do we partner with other organizations, other causes that might seem at first disjointed or separate, and find common cause? I think there's real power in that. I think it's something that the environmental movement has been doing much better in recent years, but there's so much more work to be done there. And what I love about that chapter around working together and partnering is, like, anybody can say how important it is to partner and to, like, build alliances. Mm-hmm. But what this chapter imparts upon the reader is, like, no, there are some time-tested ways to do that effectively. Like, how do you set the preconditions? How do you set the rules for engagement with one another so that we can partner and do that over the long haul sustainably in a way that is mutually beneficial? So definitely some rules for engagement and kind of best practices for doing that effectively and inclusively.
We're speaking with Nick Mucha, the Environmental Capacity Building Director at Patagonia. And we're talking about a book recently published that Nick and several others helped co-edit called Tools to Save Our Home Planet. And yeah, just to kind of attach on to that, what you're saying is that partnering can come, like I say, from pure environmental groups, like, you know, plus or minus, like Sierra Club or Audubon Society or so. But then you may find equally interested parties in faith-based groups or in Native American groups. And that's how I was thinking of Bristol Bay, the Bristol Bay challenges up in Alaska, and which brought also together local industry in the form of the fishing industry. So there are a lot of disparate groups that sometimes will disagree with each other who find, given the call, find a common cause to come together and work towards a common theme, common success.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real art to kind of look at the landscape of all the different sectors and groups that are in a particular landscape or are peripheral to a specific issue, and engage those groups again, like, very thoughtfully and meaningfully up front. Like, how do you approach? How do you listen first before starting to spout your own agenda, or, you know, ensuring that they value your values? There's a deep process of listening and building a shared vision where it can hold a variety of different perspectives. It can hold a variety of, like, political agendas, but still provide an anchor point for forward momentum. So I think that really does come through in this book, that, you know, before you just go start reaching out to other organizations or other sectors, make sure that you learn from those before you that have learned the hard way of what works when you're building those alliances and what doesn't work. And especially, you know, as the environmental movement is seeking more and more to partner with and engage and center frontline communities and fence line communities, how do you show up in a way that really uplifts their experience and uses that as kind of the roadmap for action?
And as you were constructing this and poring over these stories and case studies, what were maybe one or two that really resonated or stood out to you that you think would have a broad reach?
Oh, that is so hard. That's like picking your favorite child, because they're all so good. You know, I would say that one that really speaks to me is, you noted it earlier in the program, is Amy Bowers Cordalis, who is a Yurok woman up in Northern California, who was central to undamming the Klamath River. And this is a recent win. This happens to be the world's largest dam removal project ever. And it seemed, you know, what I really love about that example is multifold. But number one, it was so David and Goliath. I mean, to remove a series of dams on the Klamath River that have been there for decades, you would think that that would be an unmovable agenda, that that would be something that's so locked in place that why would you even bother? But thank God that Amy and her community and a coalition of other organizations continued to show up and take it one step at a time. And they found opportunities that, you know, they wouldn't have found if they were not just day in and day out engaged on that issue. And I love the fact that that was a UROC-led initiative that undammed that Klamath River. And her whole point was that, you know, people would ask, like, well, what do you think is going to happen once the dams come down? And she insisted that the water remembers. Let the water free, and the water will restore and replenish the watershed all the way out to the Pacific. And in breakneck speed, that's exactly what happened. Once those dams came down, the Klamath recovered. I mean, we're starting to see it return to its natural state. And what a lesson for all of us to know that, you know, the damage is not irreversible. We just have to set the conditions right.
Right. And obviously, not only does local cultures benefit from that, but of course, nature and ecosystems benefit from them. And maybe local economies benefit from it, from producing, promoting recreational opportunities or this, you know, the salmon return, and there's business opportunities. So there is, again, lots of benefits associated with environmental activism that are either direct or like one-off and occur maybe over time. So you have to think through that as you're trying to understand how do you achieve your goals in the environmental activism. Who's going to benefit from this ultimately, short-term, long-term?
Exactly. And I think what's really telling around that example was that the folks that would benefit, I mean, yes, there are a multitude of benefactors, right? Or beneficiaries rather, in that project alone. I mean, you could rattle them off, but I think what makes it so successful and why I uplift it so much is that it was driven by the traditional stewards of that land. The Yurok people stood to benefit the most because that's their ancestral land. That is where they go for sustenance. That is, you know, they have generations upon generations of practices and connection to that watershed, to that river. And they led the effort. And I think that there's something really potent about that example that we can really learn, that when you're able to support those that are closest to the issues, that have histories in those geographies and in those landscapes, we need to start there and support them in those efforts. And that's a really beautiful example of that community and that tribe leading the charge and now being able to benefit from its success.
We talk about the strengths and these individuals and these groups getting together and working together to make this happen. And we also talk about responsibilities of businesses. And Patagonia has always been known as one of those businesses that first, one of the foundational things about them was that they wanted to give back to the environment or be ecologically friendly to the environment. What do you think about that role that businesses should play in protecting and caring for our environment?
That's something that we've never been shy about. And I tell you, I wouldn't be working here if it was any other way. That is something that has consistently rung through our history. So we have, you know, about 50 years as a brand in business. And essentially since day one, that has been part of our ethos and our DNA. And we continue to really kind of front stage that. That is something that we will continue to lead with. I mean, we're engaged in this moment right now in a period of time where our public lands are under direct assault, you know, the question is, what do we do as a brand? Well, yes, we are grant makers. We give money to the organizations that are on the front lines of that work, but also we leverage our unique role as a business. And how do we convene other businesses and other nonprofits to engage in that space? And so recently we have been a part of and a leading part of a coalition called Brands for Public Lands. And in concert with the Conservation Alliance, which is a nonprofit organization that's helping to lead that work and organize and coordinate, we're joined by some other 80 other brands who are unequivocal in their expression around the importance of public lands and why any assault on public lands is really an assault on local economies. It's a way of life. It's this American promise. So we are, you know, in this moment, to your question, doubling down in terms of how do we focus our capabilities and our strengths as a business, as a brand, to create and assure the future that we all want to live in.
Well, I got to ask you, one of the challenges that companies like Patagonia and other clothing and apparel companies face is in the area of microplastics and microfibers. I know this is kind of a little off topic, but is there work being done by Patagonia to try to address the shedding of microfibers and microplastics from clothing and apparel that Patagonia produces?
Yeah, great question. And the answer is absolutely yes. That is a little bit adjacent to the work that I do, but that's an important point is that, right, you know, when we talk about impact, that is one of the primary ways that we can actually, in this regard, like reduce our impact, reduce our environmental negative impact. And there is a team of people way smarter than me that are engaged in that work every single day. And I think what's refreshing, you know, at least for me, is something that came into this business from the grassroots nonprofit side, is I think we have some real honesty around, you know, where we're making strides, mm-hmm, and where we still need to improve our practices. So I would say that, yeah, our work to reduce our environmental impact it's real and it's incomplete. We are continuing to wrestle with that and show how year over year we can just reduce that impact across all those dimensions. And I'm really proud to be a part of a company that, again, is sober around the fact that we're imperfect. And this is a puzzle that we will forever continue to wrestle with.
Right.
And that's where we're at.
Maybe we just return to like wool and cotton and dress and walk around in period pieces.
Well, I don't know if that solution is being made here, Chris. Okay.
Wool and cotton.
There you go. Well, we are speaking with Nick Mucha, who is the Environmental Capacity Building Director at Patagonia and has co-edited the recently published book, Tools to Save Our Home Planet. And Nick, where can people go to learn more about these writings or more about what's happening with this book?
Yeah, you can find the book on our website. You can find the book at any other kind of book retailer. We, of course, encourage people to check it out at a local bookstore. Keep those local economies strong and resilient in these troubling times. So that would be my direction. And I would end, if I may, with a quote from Senator Cory Booker, which I think that kind of encapsulates this entire book, which is, don't let your inability to do everything undermine your determination to do something. Mm-hmm. So big or small, set a low bar, read this book, and go see how can you show up? Where are you gonna lend your support?
I like that. Every bar matters.
It does, and, yeah, and we collectively
set a bar.
Yeah,
no matter what it is,
mountains for sure.
Set it.
So thank you so much, Nick. We appreciate you
being on
This Green Earth, and the book again is called "Tools to Save Our Home Planet." Thank you.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you both.
Joining us for second part of the show, as advertised, is Sarah Jo Dickens. She's an ecologist, business owner, a local business owner, and she's here to get us up to speed, now that we're slowly here in Park City at these elevations, we slowly go into spring. with some fits and starts.
Fake spring, and then real spring will come soon.
Yes. And Sarah Jo is here to talk about some updates on what's going on in the world of gardening and landscaping and invasive weeds, et cetera, et cetera. Sarah Jo, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Actually, let's start with a little background on yourself for our listeners not familiar with you. Tell them who you are.
So I run a local environmental consulting firm, Ecology Bridge, here in Summit County. We work in all of the adjacent counties as well as Utah County, helping landowners assess their properties and determine what best management practices they could be implementing just to increase whatever their goals are. Generally, it's, you know, habitat quality or water quality and protection of watersheds, things like that. But I also run the Summit CWMA, which is the Cooperative Weed Management Area, big mouthful, CWMA. Mm-hmm. And that's an organization that works to bring partners together across boundaries in order to control weeds. But not just control weeds. After you control them, what do you do next? What do you put there next? And when we make that decision, let's go native as much as possible and let's support our pollinator species and other wildlife.
And you talk a lot about noxious weeds, and it just the name in and of itself sounds a little negative, but can you explain what a noxious weed is?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a weed, which basically means it's a plant nobody wants where it's at or someone doesn't want. But noxious weeds, it's a legal classification, mm-hmm. and that is based on whether they are capable of having a significant impact on the economy. And generally, that's an impact on agriculture, but more and more in Utah, it's also an impact on recreation. Also have potential to impact natural resources and can cause human and animal health and safety concerns. So an example I like to use for that one is myrtle spurge. It's a really pretty succulent, but it has a white milky substance inside when it's damaged that can actually cause second degree burns. Ooh. And children are especially sensitive to this plant. And so clearly not something you want to have in your parks and in your backyard just for safety's sake. And so this is a legal classification by the federal government, the state government, and your counties. And by law in the state of Utah, all of these weeds, if they're on your property, it is your legal responsibility to control them.
Hmm. Really?
Yes.
So if you don't control them, are you at risk of having some form of weed police and
yes.
cite you?
Yes,
what?
For sure. Yes.
All right, talk about that.
Yeah, so according to law, if you're not controlling noxious weeds and it gets reported, or if the county weed enforcement officer sees that you're not doing it in your yard, they'll send you. Well, often our weed enforcement guy is amazing. He is really both the supervisor, Dave Bingham, and the enforcement agent, Dan Pena, are awesome. They first want to meet with you if they can.
Sure.
They would rather knock on your door, point out the issue, and guide you to a solution. If they can't get a hold of you or you're not responsive, they can send a nuisance letter. That gives you 2 weeks to address the problem.
Hmm.
If they come back in 2 weeks and you haven't done it, then they can send another letter that essentially spells out that legally they can take action in 2 weeks if you don't take action.
So come on your property.
They can come on your property. They can hire a contractor to treat
right.
your weeds. And that
MMW.
Will be herbicide for those of you who don't yeah. want to use herbicide. That is the most cost-effective way to control weeds. So it would be herbicide application. And then the county charges the landowner for the cost of that treatment and can charge them an administrative fee. Now, some people are like, well, what if I just don't pay that? It becomes a lien on your property.
Yeah.
Wow.
It just builds from there. Wow, that's really interesting. Now, if the homeowner says, I'll do it, they're the one going to probably go out and purchase some form of herbicide to control, like you say, it's the probably, I guess, unfortunately, and so the most efficient, effective way to control noxious weeds that we typically see here in Summit County?
Yeah, I would say most, actually, I don't know, maybe 50% of people would probably run out and grab an herbicide right away. But honestly, with any weeds in your property, some of them are really easily controlled by hand. If you don't have a really dense, large population, get on out there and dig them out, pull
okay.
them out, right? And that's true for plants that we consider annuals or biennials. So either they last 1 year, they germinate, flower, go to seed, die, or a biennial that will germinate 1 year, have just leaves right around the ground, and then the second year, flowers and seeds. Those plants come out of the ground pretty easily, and you just need to prevent them from making more seed and letting it hit the ground. Perennial weeds, though, that grow year after year, generally you're going to end up having to use herbicide because their root systems are deep and complex. You pull what you see above ground, and the roots down below are like, huh, you just give me a second. I'm going to be right back.
So the go-to weed killer is going to be some Roundup or something within that family. But you're saying that you mentioned that there may be there are some changes to the formulation.
Or are there alternatives? Like, what can be done?
There's both, right? So, for one thing, people often do go to Roundup. It's a name people know.
Right.
I want to clarify, Roundup is a brand. It is not the actual chemical. And it's really important for us to know that. Often when people need weed control in their property, I say, why deal with a chemical yourself? Why don't you just hire a contractor? They have studied this. They have been tested. They are licensed. They know the law. They know how to read the labels, which contain all the information on how to safely use these chemicals. The biggest misuse of herbicide happens in residential landscaping because people don't read or understand that label. And so the first thing I would say is maybe consider a contractor if you're going to go the chemical route. The second thing would be there are organic options that may or may not work depending upon the species, so you need to do some research into that. But if you're going to use a synthetic, go to Summit County. They have a program where they can help you determine what herbicide you need, and they will give you something that is not the same chemical makeup as what everyone has previously thought of as Roundup, glyphosate. They will give you something else that you can use at a much lower rate, and you can spot spray and be far more effective with far less chemical. Of course, some of these take longer to kill the plant, so you have to give it 2 to 3 weeks and let that plant die. Don't get impatient and go spray more herbicide, because if you do, you're wasting it and you're just adding chemical to the environment needlessly.
So you said go to the county. How does that work?
So you just go to the Public Works building just outside of...
Wait a minute, I just show up at the Public Works building?
You totally do, outside in Wanship. Although you might want to get on the website. I haven't checked. Usually, I think they're open Monday through Thursday.
Okay.
But it depends on their staffing. So check before you go.
Okay.
You can call if you want to, but you can just go on out there. There's somebody there all day. And tell them what weeds you are working with. Or if you don't know, but you know there's something bad going on in your yard, they have a poster there and they can talk you through determining what one it is and if it's one that you should use an herbicide for. They may even say, you know what, if I were you, I wouldn't use an herbicide. I would do this instead. And if they think an herbicide is your best bet, then they'll direct you to the right one. And then you can buy it at cost, so you're spending far less. And you can borrow the equipment to apply it.
Wow.
And that's everything from a backpack sprayer to a rig that goes on an ATV.
Wow. Well, I mean, I think I shy away from when I hear herbicide, and I know that maybe some of these things are needed, but the alternative is always something that I'm hoping people try first. And keep, because if everyone here is using a different chemical and we're neighboring and then you've got this waterway or watershed behind you, I feel like there's a lot of contribution to a lot of the bad things that are happening. So
certainly I do, even in the work that we do and the county as well, we implement other options as much as we possibly can. Of course, you know, the county and the people that the Summit CWMA partner with are dealing with thousands of acres. And so you can't hand weed thousands of acres. You can't even graze the way you need to thousands of acres of weeds, right? But there are definitely areas that we would prefer to use other alternatives, like along waterways. The CWMA really focuses on implementing hand weeding so that we're not getting herbicide application close to our streams where it may have the potential to get into the stream if they get too close,
right,
or use the wrong chemical. And that is another concern for me, right, with people who have houses next to streams and they go buy a chemical. They may get too close to the stream, and
right,
those chemicals may not be labeled to be used near water. And if they're not reading the label, that's concerning. And that's where this change in Roundup is especially concerning for me. I think there may be a group of people out there that feel like this is a win. But before you stop listening past the win, know that this is actually a change that could be more problematic. Because there isn't enough science that says that glyphosate causes cancer or is associated with cancer, the company that makes Roundup cannot put a warning on their product. Hmm. Because they can't put a warning on their product, when they're sued, they can't use that to defend themselves. So by not putting it on the product, they make themselves more likely and to be sued and have to pay settlement, but they're not allowed legally to put it on there. Hmm. So they're not in a good spot, right? So they make a decision. Was it because they wanted to do the right thing? No, but they did the right thing for a business. And what they decided was, well, let's remove Roundup from a lot of our products. Some people hear that and think, nice, Roundup, or not Roundup, remove glyphosate.
Glyphosate, yep. That's the active ingredient.
That's the active ingredient.
Glyphosate.
And people think, yay, glyphosate is gone. What they have replaced glyphosate with can be more concerning, not just because of the chemical, but because we will have people that go grab a bottle that looks exactly the same as what they bought last year and use it the same, not knowing that some of these chemicals are more dangerous if misused. And so a couple, I always write them down because I can't even pronounce them, but a couple of these chemicals, triclopyr, triethylamine salt, I never say that right. This is one that is far more mobile in the soil than glyphosate. What does that mean? Once it hits the soil, if it rains, if there's moisture, if it's close to groundwater, it is far more likely to move down the soil profile and get into our groundwater supply or move through the soil into a nearby waterway. Mm-hmm. Dibromide is moderately toxic in comparison to glyphosate. Imazapic ammonium salt is more mobile, but even more concerning is more toxic to aquatic plants and animals. So if you're a resident that goes and grabs the bottle that you recognize and you think it's glyphosate and some of those mixtures are safer to use around water, far safer than these new active ingredients, you have a dramatic risk of letting that chemical get into our soils, spreading into water. If you're near a stream and you're using the one with the imazapic ammonium salt in it, you could be causing toxicity of aquatic plants and species. That's not the intent, right? It's
right.
Just that most of us don't read labels. I mean, we buy food every day and we don't read what's in it, right?
Right.
How many of us actually pick up our cleaning supplies and read what's in the back of the on the label there and how to properly use it? We do the same thing with herbicide, and that's why the greatest misuse happens in residential landscaping. And so it's important that people know this change has happened. Read your label. If you don't understand it, reach out to USU Extension, reach out to Summit CWMA, reach out to Summit County's Weed Division. These are folks that can help you understand how to safely use the chemical or choose a different option or hire a contractor.
Well, when you get into those multiple syllables and words that we can't pronounce, that's a red flag to me, because what are those compounds? And then you have to make yourself a citizen scientist to try to figure out what you're actually putting into your soil. And I think that, you know, you would hope that a larger entity would watchdog that a little bit more, but we kind of do have to be our own advocates in this way. We have to read those labels and we have to understand our impact. We were just talking about the positive impact one individual can make and the ripple effect that could happen. We can also have a negative effect and that can ripple out as well.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. And I just want to make sure that people don't think that I'm saying that herbicides are a horrible option. They have their place in the toolbox. Mm-hmm. We just have to be very mindful about when we use them and be careful to understand how to safely use them.
Absolutely. Education is key. So what other programs are going on that can help people as they begin to look at gardening and taking care of their lawn?
So right now we are working on writing up a recent research that was done with USU and some at CWMA looking at organic herbicides. And this one's important because people have asked forever, why don't you guys just use organic? And we have always said it doesn't work. And for a long time, that's definitely been the answer. It doesn't work. Not on the weeds.
It doesn't work as well or as effective.
Right.
Or does it work at all?
In the end, it doesn't work on the species we're controlling. So, you know, if you're using an organic herbicide of the past on annual plants that have really small root systems, like some of the grasses, sometimes dandelions, things like that that don't have a deep root system, the organics can be effective. But when you're dealing with noxious weeds, they generally have these deeper root systems or waxier coatings on their leaves that just make them more difficult to control. And so some people have been effective with some of those organics, but in the long term, the weeds don't stay gone. And that's some of it's just germination of the seed bank. So every year you're going to get more until they're all gone. But a lot of times people are using them on perennial plants, and you will have to repeatedly treat them throughout the season in order to get to the goal you want for several years. So we used to say it doesn't work. You can't keep saying that. Things have changed. Mm-hmm. And so we did do this study, and we used three different organic herbicides, and we put them against the synthetic herbicide most commonly used for the weeds that we tested. And we tested it on musk thistle because it has a weak, really waxy skin and hard to treat,
right,
but is a biennial and can be pulled. Garlic mustard because it's so prevalent and we hope we can give people another option. And Canada thistle, it's a perennial, so very difficult. The chemicals we used are Weed Farm, Captain Jack, and Firehawk. And I think
those are the brands.
Those are the brands, yeah. And so
Weed Farm, Captain Jack, Firehawk. What are their active ingredients?
Some of them are an acetic acid. Some of them are nitrogen-based, but they're all organic or natural chemicals. And so when you're in the organic realm, because they don't have to go through the same rigorous labeling and testing that synthetic herbicides go through, you have to be careful. They'll say it's organic, but it's not necessarily organic, it's natural. And what does that mean? I'm not really sure, right? So you do have to be mindful, but they are not the synthetics that generally are used.
Okay, real quick, acetic acid, that's just
vinegar. It is,
why don't I just put apple cider vinegar on a spray bottle and go out and...
Oh, my God. I would love to see Chris in our neighborhood with a backpack and vinegar.
A little salad dressing.
I love it. We're just giving you our time.
Why not?
It's a great question.
Because people have told me that's what they use for spot efforts around their garden.
And so what they're doing is... anything that's organic is generally what we call a contact herbicide, and so it just burns the plant.
Right.
And you have to repeatedly burn it in order to burn out the resources that are stored below, right? With acetic acid, you have to use a really concentrated acetic
acid.
So
that's why...
So it's like a 20%, right? It's, you know, I don't remember what our apple cider vinegar is, but compared to that, what we would use to kill weeds is really very strong.
But acetic acid is an active ingredient in these others that you mentioned.
In a couple of them,
Captain Jack, Firehawk.
Right, and then they're mixed with other ingredients.
Right.
Right, and so generally when you talk to people who are using acetic acid on their own, they're mixing it with soap and salt because the salt can help with the burn and the soap can help spread the chemical over the surface of the plant. Don't ever put salt in the ground. Don't ever put salt on plants outside. Once the salt gets in the soil, you can't take it back out.
It becomes part of the chemistry of the soil. It
totally changes the soil in only negative ways. Mm. So salt is not a good option. I don't know that all of the other active ingredients in these organics don't have another impact to the soil that we need to look at. And that is something that we're hoping to look into. Mm-hmm. But that information's not there. Why? Because it's not a synthetic herbicide. So it is not forced to go through the same stringent testing as it would if it was synthetic.
Okay.
But what we did find is that these chemicals, organic, didn't really do much for Canada thistle. It just kind of stunted it. There were shorter plants. Maybe they didn't produce as much seed, but that's a big root system feeding that plant, and it just keeps coming back.
Right.
The musk thistle, it was kind of effective. It killed some of the plants. It knocked them back. Garlic mustard, surprisingly, it was very successful.
Ah.
Every one of these chemicals worked. Some of them worked better than others. I can't remember. I feel like Weed Farm was the most effective. But they're all so close in their effectiveness, it really wouldn't matter which one you used. Now, the challenge with these is you apply them every 2 to 3 weeks, three times in a row. So you're looking at least six weeks of treatment.
Wow.
Will this work in residential areas? Yes. Definitely. Will it work for the contractors that are treating thousands of acres? We can't even get there once, let alone three times every 2 to 3 weeks. So it's not an answer for large scale weed control, but it could be an answer for backyards. And now this is just a 1 year test. Like I said, we don't have the information on how it impacts soils. So I put this out there because people are looking for something other than synthetic.
Right.
But I do hope that we all continue to pay attention and try and track down that information if it becomes available. And again, still use it sparingly, just like you would a synthetic. If you can pull, do that. If you're going to use the organic, just use just what it says to use and wait.
And you have done in the past different things called garlic mustard games and all these fun things that people can get out and get together, and we as a community can help with these issues.
Definitely. And we're doing it again this year. Last year, the garlic mustard games pulled 13,000 plus pounds. And you know what? We include our contractors in that number because we want people to see that Park City actually puts a lot of money toward hand removal of weeds every year, and other partners like Basin Rec and Deer Valley, right? So we want people to see that. But over 6,000 of those pounds were volunteers. That's a huge amount of garlic mustard removed, mostly from our waterways and our forests, that we didn't have to use the same amount of herbicide or any herbicide at all to continue knocking back those populations. And so it's a fun competition. You win prizes throughout the summer. And we have we used to say a food truck party, but we actually have a taco stand party catered by Savory Kitchen in the fall to celebrate those folks. But we also have the Noxious Weed Ambassador Program, and that's for all weeds. And they're on their boxes you'll see along trails. They're orange boxes with tools to control weeds all over the county. And we pick up those bags, but people log the pounds by scanning a QR code, and every 2 weeks we give away prizes. And these are all prizes from local businesses that really are supporting this effort of reducing herbicide use.
All right, one more minute or so. Real quick, once these, let's say garlic mustard is removed, other noxious weeds removed, what do you typically replace it with?
If it's in a natural space, we start with a native grass mix.
Okay.
Because
so you're just gonna...
we're just broadcast seeding, except for some areas you really have to put in a soil amendment beforehand.
Okay.
So like a compost and a biochar blend, another conversation.
Okay.
But once all the weeds are gone, I always recommend starting with natives, always choosing wildflowers and shrubs that are native to the area. They don't need as much water. They don't need as much care. You just have to love them a little extra for a couple of years and then just let them do their thing. And you get the added benefit of more butterflies, bumblebees, birds.
And you do different trainings as well, so we can understand better how to ID these throughout the spring and into June as well.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. So we partner with Summit County to do like a deep dive weed training. That's kind of contractor level. We're looking at May 15th and June 11th for that. There's a Roots of Conservation. This is a new thing through Summit County's Natural Open Space Program, where we're going to talk about what are your resources? How do you control weeds, ID them, control them in your backyard? Tunes, Trails, and Trash is happening May 31st, and that's like a really about removing trash from our waterways, but I think it's we're starting to see people recognize noxious weeds are environmental
noxious and invasive
trash.
Species. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. These days.
Right. Well, there's so much going on. And what website would people go to learn more about this and get that information?
For us, you'll want to visit the summitcwma.org. If you're looking for herbicide information, go ahead and Google the Summit County Weed Division, Utah. Make sure Utah's in there or you're going to get info for Colorado.
Okay. Sarah Jo Dickens with Ecology Bridge. We'll have you back. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. So much good information there. So much to ponder.